Hello and good evening, everybody. My name is Martin Reed. I'm the Deputy Director of LSE Library, and I'm very pleased to welcome you all to this evening's event. It's been jointly organised by the Library, Spectrum, which is LSE's network for LGBT plus staff, and Open Doors London, and is part of our celebration of Gay History Month. This is, of course, a particularly significant year for lesbian and gay history, as we mark 50 years since the passing of the Sexual Offences Act in 1967, which partially decriminalised homosexuality in this country. So I'm delighted to be able to welcome our distinguished and multi-talented speaker this evening, Peter Scott-Pesland, to talk about the pioneering early years of the campaign for homosexual equality, which is one of the most important and influential groups pushing for a change in the law in the 1960s. The Library is particularly pleased to welcome Peter, as he is a regular and long-standing user of our collections and reading room, and is an immensely valuable, critical friend and advisor in our efforts to develop and promote our LGBT collections. And I'm proud to say that these collections are among the best in the country. And in the form of the Hall Carpenter Archives, they include the papers of a wide range of key organisations and individuals involved in the struggle for lesbian and gay rights over the last 50 years and more. These include not only the Campaign for Homosexual Equality, which Peter has done such fantastic work on, but also the Albany Trust, the Gay Liberation Front, the Lesbian and Gay Christian Movement, and the Gay London Police Monitoring Group. You can get a sense of the range of material we have in our collections in the current the Library's current exhibition, Glad to Be Gay, which is on display in the Library Gallery at the entrance to the Library building until the beginning of April. If you haven't already done so, I would urge you to go and have a look if you get the chance. It's open 9 until 7, Monday to Friday, and also 11 until 6 Saturdays and Sundays, so there's really no excuse not to go and have a look. One or two housekeeping points for this evening. Tonight's lecture is being recorded, and assuming there are no technical problems, it will be made available as a podcast on the LSE website, and Peter is also being filmed for posterity. The Twitter users, the hashtag for this evening's event is ODL50, and I'd ask you to put your phones on silent so as not to disturb this evening's event. Peter has very kindly agreed to take some questions at the end of his talk, so please do start thinking of things to ask Peter while he's speaking. There will also be a reception at the end, to which you're all very cordially invited. So please do join us to help celebrate and continue the debate after the end of this talk. And I'm also pleased to say that Peter brought along some copies of his book, Amiable Warriors, which you will be signing after tonight's talk. I'm now going to hand over to Professor Geoffrey Weeks, who is Chair of Opening Doors London, to formally introduce Peter.
It's my great pleasure to welcome you on behalf of ODL. Open Doors London, as I hope you know, I'll soon know about more, is the largest organisation in Britain, actually, for older LGBT people, and is an organisation of older people and for older LGBT people. And we do a range of services, which hopefully you'll learn more about as we go on this evening. It's going to be my pleasure to introduce Peter in a moment or two, but I wanted to say something about my own experience of the LSE, because when Gay Liberation started at LSE in October 1970, I was actually working here on a research project. I'd started in September, so the next month Gay Liberation started, and after a couple of weeks of hesitation, I went along to my first meeting there, and I can honestly say it changed my life completely. completely, and the after effects of that are still living with me. It also has a special meaning for me this year, because when I was working at LSE, I wrote my first book coming out, which was the first history of the LGBT movement, as we didn't call it then, in Britain, and that was coming out. And I've just produced the 40th edition of this, which is updated, and hopefully some of you will gain something from it. This is very much a preliminary history, and I've been longing for a long time for people to fill in the gaps. In the last 10 or 15 years, in fact, there's been quite a flourishing of LGBT history, with some excellent material produced. But actually, very little of it has been directly on the movement itself. So it was my delight when Peter took over the responsibility for doing history of the Campaign for Homosexual Equality. The first volume of that is out, and as Martin said, copies are available at the back, which Peter will sign after this talk. Peter himself, of course, was involved in the gay liberation movement from the early 70s, and I've known him since then with a range of activities that he's been involved in. The book itself, I think, is a wonderful read. I said to him when it first came out that it reminded me of a great Victorian novel. It's full of riches, it's full of gossip, it's full of challenging insights, it's rich and diverse, and you can lose yourself in its detail. And I'm looking forward immensely to the subsequent volumes. The first volume only takes us up really to the early 70s, but what he shows, I think, is two things that I think are really important, especially in the wake of our thinking about 1967 and its implications. The first thing is that, and the really interesting thing I got from the detail in that book, is that lots of things were bubbling on the ground before they publicly emerged. First of all, with the tremendous breakthrough of gay liberation in October 1990, and then the consolidation of different grassroots activities, largely through the Campaign for Homosexual Equality. I mainly came through the GLF strand, and as I said earlier, it's affected my life ever since. Many others came through the CHE strand. And by the mid-70s, I think, in effect, the two different strands were really one. But that reminds me of what the second thought is that comes out of Peter's book. And that's the immense diversity and richness of the activities that were going on right from the start. GLF has tended to have a stereotype of being rather straight-laced politically and rather absolutist in its views, and in many ways it was. But actually, of course, it embraced a wide range of people, originally London-based, but soon spreading to other parts of the country. CHE was a different sort of organisation, often not particularly political, but nevertheless doing that essential task of wielding people into a coherent social and networking community. And its role in history is often forgotten, but Peter is doing stalwart work in telling us of what actually did happen in immense detail with immense richness. Today he's going to talk about the North and the South, which in some ways might superficially seem to be about GLF and CHE in different parts of the country, but I'm sure we'll actually show that there was much greater intercourse in many different ways and many other cross currents and cross winds throughout the formative period of the 1970s. So it gives me great pleasure to introduce Peter to us today, and he's going to speak for about 40 minutes. and then there'll be a chance for discussion afterwards. Peter.
What an introduction. I don't think I can live up to that, Jeff. Thanks very much. I feel very honoured by what you said, Jeff, because you started it all. I mean, you made LGBT history real for the first time. You gave us a sense that we had a history, and it was important, and we were important parts of that history. So thank you for that very much. And thank you, too, to the LSE for organising this, and to Chris for opening the doors. It's lovely to be in this room, the Shaw Library, George Bernard Shaw, who does make a walk-on appearance in this particular talk I'm going to give. I've called it A Tale of North and South, and in fact it's not CHE and GLF, but it's slightly more fundamental culturally and goes back a lot further. Some of you, like me, will have been approached by a lot of TV and radio researchers anxious to prick your brains, on an unpaid basis, of course, for anniversary programmes about the passage of the Sexual Offences Act of 67. I'm rather worried about these. In the first place, the programme maker's primary interest has been to find people who've been arrested, people who suffered under the old law. And again, it's the homosexual as victim, homosexuality as a problem. And the second part of the story, which they're coming up with, is, and as told by most of the media, is how the enlightened, liberal, heterosexual, great and good rescued these poor, benighted homosexuals from outer darkness through their parliamentary activities. This is not the whole story. It's not even part of the story, or even half the story. Andrew Lumsden, founder of Gay News and an early GLF member, has a very good image about this. He likens the campaign for law reform to those Roman cohorts that you see in films like Gladiator, who are advancing slowly under those big shields which make a wall. The heterosexual great and good, or HGAG as we can call them, are the shield for our people. No one would have given credence to a campaign by homosexuals because it would have been special pleading. In the same way that a campaign against capital punishment would lose its credence if it was led by convicted murderers. That was actually the analogy that was used at the time. But the contrary story, which I'm going to tell tonight, is of the foot soldiers, of the gay men who propelled that campaign for law reform behind the HGAG shield. No victims there. Their conditions were awful for some, there is no doubt. Oscar Wilde prophesied that after he came out of prison, that the road will be red with monstrous martyrdoms, but we shall win. And martyrs there were aplenty. As we come up to this celebration, let us pause for a moment and remember George Butler. George Butler hanged himself in Durham Jail in 1959 after he was refused bail when he was up on a sexual offence. He was 17 years old. Let us remember George Brigham, one-time chair of the Labour Party National Executive, who in 1962 picked up a young cellar man, Lawrence Summers, in Soho, took him to tea and then to the cinema, and then invited him back to his flat. He said to Summers, "Give us a kiss," and tried to put his arms around the lad, who hit him with a decanter four times and smashed his skull in. When it came to the trial, the defence maintained that, quote, "one is entitled to kill if a man commits a forcible and atrocious crime against you." And the judge, Mr. Justice Paul, agreed that it was, quote, "about as clear a case of provocation as it is possible to have." Paul ordered the jury to acquit, even of manslaughter, and Summers went back to a hero's welcome at his hometown of Matlock, where they put out the bunting. While waiting in prison for trial, Summers received hundreds of letters of support. All the warders at Brixton Prison congratulated him and shook his hand as he left discharge a free man. And he sold his story for several thousand pounds to the News of the World, "The Night I Killed George Brigham." In the face of this judicial and social encouragement to murder, the Labour Party said nothing. Lawrence Summers is about 70 now. I wonder if he sleeps at night. Let us remember the 19-year-old man in Abergavenny, one of 29 people caught up in a police trawl who killed himself by lying on a railway line so that a train rang over his head and exploded his skull. Another of the accused, an ex-RAF fighter pilot, tried to kill himself by taking 132 aspirins. And let us remember Albert Goldstraw. In 1936 in Altrincham in Cheshire, Albert got 7 years imprisonment with 18 months hard labour for being a member of a, quote, homosexual vice ring. 23 years later, in 1959, in nearby Sale, there was another roundup of gay men. Among them, the same Albert Goldstraw, obviously not a whit deterred by his previous sentence. He came up in front of the same judge, who had a long memory. This time, he got 5 years. That's a total of 12 years out of Albert Goldstraw's allotted 70. Purely for consensual acts, purely in private. Monstrous martyrdoms indeed. Albert Goldstraw now has a posthumous pardon. Fat lot of use it is to him. Amber Rudd should go down on her knees grovelling in front of Albert Goldstraw and the memory of his blighted life. Nothing less than an abject government apology and a martyr's memorial will do. But there is another story. There are several other stories. When I first came out to my parents, I was told that I was condemned to loneliness because none of our relationships could last. My mother didn't mind that I was gay, but she was terribly worried that I would die on my own, alone and sad. But as I researched for the history of the campaign for homosexual equality, I keep coming across people in happy partnerships that lasted 40, 50, even 60 years. Of the early campaigners, Anthony Gray, Tony Dyson, Alan Horsfall all had secure, if open, loving relationships. If they strayed, they did so into a world of cheerful promiscuity. Friends of Alan told me at his funeral that at the pub they habitually went to in the 1960s, the Elgin in Manchester, there was a curtain over an alcove at the back of the saloon bar, and you disappeared behind it when you wanted a quick hand job or a blow job. The landlady would always be on the lookout for you to warn you if the police were coming in. And after the pubs closed, they all went home on what was called locally the Bugger's Bus, and screaming their tits off, merry as a whistle. Martin George, the manager of the CHE London Information Centre in Soho, used to commute in there from his home in Harrow. He told me that the Metropolitan Line trains were so crowded in the rush hour that he could have sex with other commuters standing up, and no one else in the carriage would notice. If you stood on the platform, say, at Great Portland Street and watched people get off the train, you could tell who had been doing this because they always carried their briefcase in front of their crotch to hide any stains. So for every illegal sex act and for every tragedy, there were hundreds, even thousands, of enjoyable, cheerful, illegal encounters, deep and meaningful, shallow, cheap and cheerful, which went unremarked. For every lonely, isolated homosexual, there were two in a committed, loving relationship. And beyond that, there were the politics. People date campaigning from against the state of the law from the appearance of the Wolfenden Report. But it began much, much earlier. The Progressive League, an alliance of progressive societies founded by H.G. Wells, published a 10-point manifesto in 1932, calling, among other things, for legalised abortion, repeal of the divorce laws, and an end to the discriminatory laws on homosexuality. Among those who were involved were J.B. Priestley, married to the bisexual archaeologist Jacquetta Hawkes, Compton Mackenzie, married to the lesbian Faith Stone, Barbara Wootton, Bertrand Russell. All these turned up as supporters of homosexual law reform 25 years later. Priestley and Hawkes, in particular, were very supportive, letting the Homosexual Law Reform Society Committee meet at their flat, or set as they're called in the Albany, they're not flat, down the corridor from Edward Heath. The counselling charity, the Albany Trust, grew out of the HLRS and was named after the flat in their honour. Priestley wrote at least one article in the popular press during the 1940s advocating homosexual law reform. But he was beaten to it during the war by Robert Reed, a disgraced former public school headmaster who lost his job following a trial at the Old Bailey for having sex with a cinema usher who he met at the Granada Cinema Tooting. The experience radicalised him, and he became the first person in modern times, as far as I'm aware, to stand up publicly in front of an audience and say, this is what we homosexuals want. In February 1944, at a conference of the Prison Medical Reform Council, at which George Bernard Shaw was present, and which was reported in the papers, he said this: I wonder if you realise what it means to a man to have his finer instincts held up to scorn, dragged into the mud and trampled underfoot, all his privacies exposed in a public court, his private papers ransacked, and his very love letters sneered at by judges and lawyers, his reputation ruined so that he cannot again appear in places familiar and dear to him, his savings taken by lawyers and medical experts in an often vain endeavour to secure mitigation of sentence, and lastly, abandonment by most of his friends. You see, the homosexual's desire is not perverse, he says. It is his finer instincts. He writes love letters like any heterosexual. When Angus McBean was on trial in Bath, the prosecution introduced his love letters to him from his 16-year-old lover Tom Gill in court. Had they been written to a young woman with whom Gill was in love, they would easily pass as normal love letters, says the prosecution. So Robert Reed could have been speaking for Tom Gill and McBean only 2 years later. What do homosexuals want? Firstly, a repeal of the life sentence provision, that's life imprisonment for buggery. Secondly, reform of the law so that they suffer exactly the same penalties for sexual offences as their heterosexual brothers. Thirdly, a reform of police methods, including the even administration of the existing law. The fact is that the homosexual would be no better and no worse than anyone else if only we were left alone. Fine, vivid, angry, fighting talk for 1944. Come the 50s, come increasingly high-profile court cases, come the Wolfenden Committee, set up by a government prompted by a bisexual man, Lord Boothby, chaired by a man with a gay son, John Wolfenden. And honour to the three gay men who appeared in front of the Wolfenden Committee as open homosexuals: Patrick Trevor Roper, the Queen's eye surgeon, and Carl Winter, the director of the Fitzwilliam Museum in Cambridge, a last-minute substitute for the novelist Angus Wilson. They calmly describe the realities of gay life, with all its ups and downs, pleasures and downs, to a group of people who were so terrified of the subject that they had to call homosexuals and prostitutes hunkies and palmers after the biscuit factory in Reading, where Wolfenden was vice-chancellor. The bumbling, amateurish Wolfenden Committee took 3 years to produce a mouse of a report, less guided by rationality than by a vague apprehension of what they might get away with in Parliament. Legalised sex with men at 21. It was published on the 4th of September 1957, and nothing happened. The roundup of men continued. Enter Robert Reed, writing for The Spectator in January 1958, following a series of raids in Bath. Surely, he said, we should have a support group for these men on trial, their families and friends. He was one of the first to make the point that it is not only the accused who suffers in these exercises in public humiliation. A week later, back comes a letter from Tony Dyson to The Spectator, an English lecturer at Bangor University, saying, no, it's not a support group we need. We need a campaign to change this awful law. Dyson was a high Anglican Tory and an ardent monarchist who found the love of his life through the campaign. Cliff Tucker, a Camden councillor who he lived with for 35 years. Enter also another homosexual martyr who turned his martyrdom to a positive force for change. Peter Wildblood, society columnist for the Daily Mail, who had been sent to prison for 18 months on the perjured word of two airmen, along with Lord Montague of Bewley and his Norfolk neighbour, Michael Pitt Rivers. The case was the front page of the Red Tops for weeks. For many people, it was the first hint they'd had that homosexuality really existed. So well known was it entered folklore by becoming a rugby song. On the first day of Christmas, my true love sent to me my Lord Montague of Bewley. On the second day of Christmas, my true love sent to me two Boy Scouts and my Lord Montague of Bewley. And so it goes on. The other two got 6 months apiece. Wildman got 18 because he decided quite deliberately to come out as gay during his trial. At the end of his sentence, he wrote an angry campaigning book against the law, which was hugely influential on the campaign to change that law. It was submitted in evidence to Wolfenden, and at one point a copy was sent to every MP in the Commons. Wildblood gave evidence to the Wolfenden committee in person, although he was treated with barely disguised contempt by Sir John. He was, after all, a convicted convict criminal, so his evidence could be discounted as special pleading. Wildblood was one of the first to get in touch with Tony Dyson about his campaign, and he brought with him the greatest asset any journalist can bring to a campaign, his contact book. 3 months later, there were 33 signatories on a letter to the Times, and in May 1958, the HLRS, the Homosexual Law Reform Society, was launched. The model for it, in the background for the society, was CND and the Committee of 100, and many of the same people came on board for both causes. Now we turn north to Nelson in Lancashire and a man called Alan Horsfall, son and grandson of publicans, gay, living with a partner 20 years older, a primary school teacher called Harold Pollard. They'd been together for 10 years. Alan wrote to Reynolds News in early 1958 to say that Wolfenden must be implemented. Reynolds News was a left-wing Sunday paper. There was no response from it for weeks, and in the meantime, Alan had become an elected Labour councillor. Much to his surprise, there was a landslide that year, and the council went 100% Labour for the first and only time. This changed things completely. Everyone around him read Reynolds News. Everyone around him read that, and surely somebody would see his letter with his name attached, saying this thing about Wolfenden. He'd lose his seat. He'd be booted out of the Labour Party. In a state of panic, he wondered who he could turn to. And he thought of Peter Wildblood, who alone of all recent correspondents had his full address published in The Spectator, 50 St Paul's Road, N1. Not the fashionable address it is now. Much of his income was a slum in the 1950s. So Alan comes down to London, turns up on Peter Wildblood's doorstep, a bombsite on the other side of the road. "Can I come in? I've got something on my mind. Can I talk to you?" "Of course, come in, come in." As the best known homosexual in the country, Wildblood was well used to other gay men coming up and turning up on his doorstep and pouring out their hearts to him. "What can I do for you, Alan?" And Alan told him the situation about his fears of being cast out of the local community, and Wildblood said to him, look at it this way. What's the worst thing that could happen to you? And could you cope with it? And then look at what happened to me. I was in prison for 18 months. I lost my job. And I'm still here. I've written a successful autobiography, a best-selling novel, now turned into a musical that's just about to go to the West End. If I've survived and triumphed, so can you. And Alan went back up north, revitalised, to continue the campaign. He wanted to start a local branch of the Homosexual Law Reform Society, which then had a husband and wife secretariat, and was convinced that everyone should leave it to London, and to them in particular. The wife, Venetia Newell, wrote back to Alan. I think this is her voice, this is what I get from the letter anyway. "Unfortunately, we always found in this office that although we get many splendid, able and willing volunteers, we always seem to get a percentage of crackpots and shifty types as well. I don't understand why, but the office acts like a magnet to them, and one has to be so very careful. Our work is so valuable, we don't want to endanger it in any way by taking risks, do we? Trust us, you northern oik, even if you are a councillor, leave the experts to it, we know what we're doing." This was incidentally mirrored in the treatment which the society itself received from the makers of the film Victim. They asked for a sight of the script, and the scriptwriter Janet Green wrote back to them. As you know, we've studied the subject for years, read almost every book written about it during recent years, and talked with doctors, policemen, and inverts themselves. We were quite horrified at your suggestion that the screenplay should be given to an invert to read. Any comments would only be biased and disastrous to our respective objective viewpoints. Obviously, homosexuals couldn't be objective, and they'd turn the precious film into propaganda. The situation changed a little, however, when the HLRS got its first gay secretary, Anthony Gray, in 1962. Anthony was hamstrung by the H-gag. He was under pressure never to reveal his homosexuality. He didn't use his real name. But he was a great galvaniser and planter of seeds and networker who put people in touch with each other. On his watch, the HLRS acquired a cohort of young gay men, male volunteers, who staffed the new office in Shaftesbury Avenue, a run-down building, four floors up, lifts hardly working, toilets smelling of pee. These boys addressed envelopes, solicited donations, bent the ear of potential supporters, all the things that volunteers in queer organisations still do. They too were forbidden to come out as gay, but Anthony founded a set of three discussion groups, each of which had about 20 people in it, met weekly, and followed what was almost a syllabus devised by Anthony, a kind of crash course in homosexuality. Anthony realised that not only was it necessary to educate the public about homosexuality, but also to educate homosexuals about themselves. The story of LGBT rights over the last 50 years is only partly about convincing the external world. The other half of the story is about convincing homosexuals that they deserved rights, that they were worthy of them as human beings. So these weekly discussion groups were very serious. They came with reading lists. You were expected to do your homework. Here's just a few of the subjects they discussed. Psychiatry, promiscuity, the Kama Sutra, the homosexual problem, Montesquieu, D.H. Lawrence and sex, and slightly bizarrely, the Salvation Army. At the end of 6 months, you pretty much got an A-level in queer studies. Again, people were discouraged from identifying as gay or indeed from talking about themselves at all, except in the context of the subject of that week. But willy-nilly, of course it came up and people shared their feelings. And so the meetings became a kind of consciousness-raising, almost in spite of themselves. Meanwhile, Anthony gave Alan permission to start a Northwest branch and came up to Manchester for the first meeting in October 1964, bringing a cheque for £10 as seed money to get the group going. Alan got leaflets printed and, with the bravery of total naivety, put his home address on it, because there was no office. He was also over the front page of the local paper, the Lee Reporter. Homosexuals and the law, Hindford man is heading the local campaign. Across eight columns, the kind of headline you only get for the outbreak of war. But there was a reason Alan did it. Homophobia was rife in the Labour Party, as we've seen. And at party conferences, Alan had come up with, well, of course, I believe in law reform, personally, but my constituents, the miners, would never stand it. And here was a man starting a homosexual campaign, living in a mining village, and lo, the sky didn't fall in. The opposition came from other gay men. Don't rock the boat. Don't draw attention to us. When Alan went into his local pub, people who had been his friends for years until now pointedly went to the other end of the bar. They took Harold, his partner, aside and said, look, you really ought to leave, Alan, you know. After all, you're a primary school teacher. You'll be out of a job if people find out. But Harold didn't leave. And later, after he retired, he became president of the Northwest Homosexual Law Reform Committee, as Alan called his group. So Alan and his little band of local supporters that Gray had brought together met in the boardroom of the Bishop of Middleton, Ted Wickham. Ted was a bruiser, an ex-boxer, worked his way up in the city parishes, one of the very few working-class clergy with a reputation for upsetting his hierarchy. He got the support of a local club owner, Reg Kilduff, who ran the Rockingham Club. The Rockingham was the one gay place in Manchester which never got raided, thanks to the large handouts and crates of scotch that Reg gave to the police. Every Saturday night they could be seen loading them up into the back of a police car. Reg let them have, they let them have collecting tins in the pubs, but only with initials on them, nothing explicit. And under the counter they went when the police came in. But Alan and the others could go around and talk to everybody about what they were doing in the club and about the need for law reforms. And so, unlike the London movement, which remained firmly in the hands of HGAG on the committee, the North West Committee, which started with vicars and social workers and doctors, became, over time, a committee largely made up of gay men. It became a grassroots organisation. And in doing this, it drew on a different tradition, the tradition of self-help, exemplified by the Rochdale Pioneers, Samuel Smiles, Working Men's Clubs, the Workers' Educational Association, all the cooperative efforts for self-improvement coming from the liberal left and labour movements, which saw self-made industrialists endowing libraries, parks and art galleries for the working class in the north, a habit which caught on in the south later on. And I'll note here also that Anthony Gray was both half Syrian and a northerner from Sheffield, and I like to think that his discussion groups at odds with the predominant HLRS culture came from that tradition. I mentioned that the North West Committee was largely gay men, but there were two notable women involved. Rosalind Hargreaves went on to head the Social Science Research Unit at the University of Kent and helped set up the East Kent Gay Group in the early 70s. And Meg Atkins, one of my favourite characters in all these stories. Meg Elizabeth Atkins was working as a secretary in Manchester, having escaped her horsey family, and was trying to make her way as a novelist. She'd had two novels published, one of which, The Gemini, was about twins, one gay, one straight. And she had a gay friend. And she was outraged at the way he was treated, so she joined the committee. And then she decided that she really ought to do something practical to help, to put her money where her mouth was. And what she decided was that she would tackle personnel officers, human resources, and she'd do it on the biggest industrial estate in Manchester, the Trafford Estate, where Metro Vic made railway carriages, indeed still do, I think. Meg, I should explain, was impossibly glamorous. I met her when she was in her 80s, and even then she had a model's high cheekbones and the kind of skeleton, clothes horse figure that could make any old rags look like Christian Dior. Let her tell her story as she did to me in her interview. I had to psych myself up to do it. I'd always be very well dressed and presentable, hat and gloves. I would go in and say, "May I see your welfare officer, please?" And they thought to themselves, "Well, she's not selling something." And they said, "Who are you?" And I said, "I'm from the Law Reform Society." If I said homosexual, I wouldn't have got in. But that was the attitude of the time. Once I was in, of course, I came clean immediately. But I felt people should talk. Nowadays, we'd call it raising awareness. It was mainly men. And though if there was a woman for a welfare officer, she was very sympathetic and understanding. The man would take me into his office, sit me down. "So, you're from the Law Reform Society." "Well, actually, I'm from the Homosexual Law." "Oh." Pause. A big pause. And then I just had to say that there's a great deal of pressure on now for change in the law. "You're probably aware of that, is there?" Or "Yes," or "About bloody time," or "Over my dead body, there shouldn't be." The whole gamut of possible reactions. There was one guy who was very leering, very crude, which was the kind of thing you would meet there. And another man tried to make a date with me. It was terribly funny. I wouldn't have been seen dead with him. I would have to play it by ear to take it from there. If I had a totally unsympathetic person I'd speak to, I knew I wasn't going to get very far, so I just said, "Perhaps you'd be interested in the literature," and they'd get out quickly. Or, "Obviously I'm in the wrong place." "Yes, you bloody well are." Or I'd say, "Thank you for listening. Thank you for your time." But sometimes people were relieved to talk. Quite a lot of people did say to me, "Well, we have had difficulties." Of course, it was illegal then, so they couldn't show support. I never had any tangible evidence of what effect it had, but it was just building contacts. It contributed to a climate of opinion. You've got to start somewhere. Mine was a tiny contribution to it. When my mother found out I joined the society, she was speechless with horror. We didn't talk about it. And the boyfriend I had at the time I joined, he said, "You mustn't tell anybody." I said, "What do you mean? If I want to talk about it, I'll talk about it." He said, "You don't realise it would damage your reputation." "What, you mean as a writer? I've only just started out and got a reputation." "Although I will have." He said, "Yes, and it'll damage it." The amount of prejudice was awful. It was hurtful. It used to hurt me. So there, I think, is another somebody who ought to have a memorial. I can see her in her hat and, you know, the long gloves, the evening gloves, and the big picture hat on a statue on the Trafford Estate. Audrey Hepburn among the working class. At the same time, Anthony and Alan were going out and talking to groups of all kinds. They were talking to women's institutes, housewife registers, rotary clubs, trade unions, church groups. Alan was buttoning local MPs to support law reform when it came up. Humphrey Barclay was the first MP who took it up, a gay MP with a rather haughty attitude to his colleagues and even more snobby about his constituents. He lost his seat in the 1966 election, not for his support for gay rights or because he was queer, but more for his distant and contemptuous attitude. So eventually it was a maverick eccentric who finally took law reform on the House of Commons, the exhibitionist camp heterosexual Leo Absey. It's not entirely clear why he did it. Nobody else wanted to stick their necks out to start the ball rolling if they had any hopes of preferment in politics. Alan and Anthony kept up a vigorous correspondence. They moaned about the fact that they seemed to be doing all the work and nobody else on their committee would support them properly. Cry familiar to all activists down to this day. They raged about the compromises that Leo Absey was making in watering down a bill which had originally been drafted by Anthony's partner, a very senior civil servant. Sadly, they realised that once an MP had agreed to take on a bill and push it through Parliament, they had absolutely no control over what he and the government law officers did with it. Alan and Anthony cackled like anything when the homophobe MP for Cheadle, William Shepherd, was routed in debate and finally lost his seat to Liberal HLRS supporter Michael Winstanley. And eventually, truncated and deformed, the bill limped onto the statute books in July 1967. And here is where the North-South divide becomes most significant. In the South, all those heterosexual supporters, the big names on the committee, thought to themselves, "Job done," and drifted away to other causes. The chair, Professor A.J. Eyre, resigned. The money stopped coming in, and all the staff, there were about six or seven paid staff at the height of the campaign, had to be laid off. The Albany Trust survived as a counselling service for all kinds of sexual problems, but the HLRS became a tiny rump campaigning on general issues of law and sexuality. Anthony left the HLRS and became, to my mind, if not a sad figure, a slightly lost one, looking for a place within the gay world which would satisfy him, stretch him, enable him to contribute, and appreciate him when he was somewhat dismissed and his work devalued. The Orson Welles of the LGBT movement, his great work done before he was 40. But in the North it was different. The South, with its counselling charity, concentrated on homosexuality as a problem. The North, with its committee of gay men cheerfully having sex in the pub and going off for dirty drinks together at Blackpool, wanted none of that. Even before the Act was passed, a committee meeting resolved, "We don't want social workers, we want social centres." And thus began a 10-year battle to start gay clubs, esquire clubs, on the lines of the Northern men's, Northern working men's clubs. With cheap booze, yes, but food and entertainment and dancing and a library and advice sessions and film shows and maybe workshops too, and all owned and run by the members who would plough the profits back into other clubs and political campaigns. When this great project became known, there was hell to pay. Clubs were denounced by Leo Absey and by Lord Arran, who had piloted reform through the House of Lords. Arran, yes. Arthur Strange Cattendike David Archibald Gore, 8th Earl of Arran. Another eccentric, a junior government whip in the Lords, known to his friends as Boofy, who drank half a bottle of champagne every day before lunch. He was married to a powerboat racer, and the two of them loved badgers, which they allowed to roam freely in their house. They used to wear Wellington boots indoors to prevent themselves being bitten by the badgers. Aaron got involved in the law reform campaign out of a sense of deep guilt and shame because he inherited his title from his older brother, who was gay, and who committed suicide 9 days after he succeeded to the title, because suddenly he was in the public eye with this dark secret and he couldn't deal with the stresses. This is part of Aaron's closing speech on the final reading in the Lords, and indeed you've got it on display downstairs. I ask one thing and I ask it earnestly. I ask those who have, as it were, been in bondage and for whom the prison doors are now open to show their thanks by comporting themselves quietly and with dignity. This is no occasion for jubilation, certainly not for celebration. Any form of ostentatious behaviour now or in the future, any form of public flaunting would be utterly distasteful and would, I believe, make the sponsors of the bill regret that they have done what they have done. No amount of legislation will prevent homosexuals from being the subject of dislike and derision, or at best of pity. That is their burden for all time, and they must shoulder it like men, for men they are. And here were homosexuals now, and they were going to advertise their meeting places. They were going to admit people under 21. They were going to encourage people to go to these Esquire clubs. No wonder, Boofy said in his weekly column in the London Evening News, had I known that this would be the result, I would never have introduced Bill, sexual offences, his joke. Mm-hmm. Anthony Gray condemned the idea of clubs. All the members of the HLRS committee, except sociologist Michael Schofield and pianist Peter Kentin, condemned clubs. It was too soon. It was rocking the boat. No other LGBT issue provoked such outrage until the paedophile smears of the late 1970s and the arrival of AIDS in the 1980s. Why? There was no suggestion that the clubs were themselves illegal. The outrage was because here were gay people claiming autonomy and stepping out from behind that Roman shield and thus threatening to get out of control. Two or three times, Esquire clubs got very close to happening, most famously in Burnley in 1971. But the most important legacy from them was the idea of the gay centre, which flowered in several cities, Edinburgh, Belfast, Dublin, Bristol, Birmingham, and reached its apotheosis in the late 1980s with the late, much-lamented London Lesbian and Gay Centre. But when in the North they were thwarted by a mixture of finance, lack of money, and local bigotry, they developed instead the idea of local groups, which could meet anywhere. In this they were also inspired by the heterosexual singles clubs of the time, the InterVarsity Club, the Octopus Clubs, which flourished in the 1960s with the new social mobility and with that symbol of freedom, the self-contained flat. CHE realised that gay space did not depend on bricks and mortar, but was created by LGBT people wherever they came together. And here it joined up again with the South, because once it decided to go national, once the HLRS had collapsed, it could start local groups in London on the basis of the old discussion groups that Anthony Gray had started. CHE went on to become the only democratic mass LGBT organisation, if a formal membership of 6,000 plus can be described as mass, that this country has ever known. Over the next 10 years, there were about 180 local groups, from Cornwall to Newcastle, from the Isle of Man to Hastings. Much has been made of the inadequacies of the 1967 Act, the exclusion of the armed forces, the Merchant Navy, Northern Ireland, and Scotland, the straitjacketing definition of privacy. As we know, prosecutions actually rose in the 5 years after the passage of the Act. Less has been made of the truly shackling clause, a new restriction created by the Act, which created the crime of procuring a man for another man to commit buggery with and laid down the penalty of 2 years, even though the sex itself was perfectly legal. It was what Brian Sewell called the Porsche betrayal. You could have your pound of flesh, but no blood. You could have sex, but you couldn't meet anybody to have sex with. This last restriction severely inhibited all forms of self-organisation for years. counselling organisations for teenagers and youth workers in general were particularly terrified of it. But what the passage of the Act, or even more, the process of campaigning for the Act achieved was it opened the door a tiny way for starting to create a sense of justice, a sense of entitlement, a sense of solidarity, a vague outline for the shape of equality, and a way of coming together which would lead to CAG, to the Gay Liberation Front, to AIDS activism, to SAFO, to trans organisations, all of which, with the exception of the Gay Liberation Front, follow the basic northern CHE model. While Stonewall, when it came, turned out in many respects to look remarkably similar to the Homosexual Law Reform Society. To return finally to those researchers I started from, what I've been telling them is threefold. First, that the 1967 Act would never have happened without the brave involvement of LGBT people, even if they could not declare it at the time. Secondly, that the inadequacies in the Act were entirely the result of the loss of nerve of the heterosexual supporters of the bill and caused intense frustrations for gay campaigners at the time. And thirdly, that the significance of the Act lay not in the law, the wording, the enforcement, but in the process by which it came together and set people talking about homosexuality and thinking about their rights and what equality might actually mean. In the same way, going to university is nothing about the degree that you get, but everything about the experience of having 3 years at a university. I hope the researchers have been listening, and that some of what I call the queer perspective, as opposed to the straight perspective of the 67 Act, shows up on our screens this coming summer. But I have to say, I'm not holding my breath. Thank you.
Yes, I just wanted to thank you very much for that really, it was a fantastic talk. It was really fascinating and also inspiring. I think there were some wonderful stories in there, and I particularly like the term age gag. That's definitely one I'm going to start using. So we do have some time for questions. So if you'd like to ask Peter a question about anything that he's been talking about tonight, please do so. We've got some mics roving around, so if you've got a couple of questions.
I can repeat the question. Well, at the front. I work at school, and currently, this month, I've been making a couple of PowerPoints to show to the children, because some of their opinions are not quite what I think they should be. What do you think still needs to be done? Because from my observations, we haven't really got equality in terms of the way that we're perceived. What, in your view, still needs to be done?
Well, I think the great thing is you need role models. That is the most important thing. And the best thing that any teacher who is gay or bisexual or trans or whatever can do is actually come out at school if they can do it. I realise the problems with that. The second thing is you need to support LGBT pupils. I was gobsmacked last year when I went back to my old school, which is Highgate in North London, and they've actually got an LGBT society in the school, which was started by a gay pupil. When I was there, it was a single-sex, mainly boarding school, and it just blew me away. And basically, it was embedded in the school life. The LGBT society had joint meetings with the History Society, and so on. They have people along to talk to them. I went back and talked to them about, you know, the 1960s and stuff. And I think that's how, what we need to do is normalise. I hate that word. Usualise, maybe better. LGBT. That's what we need to do. I know it's a hell of a difficult thing to do. And I think if you are gay and you're trying to do this, you can feel really, really exposed. But there are outside resources that you can draw on. There is Schools Out. And Andrew Plastow, who's the teacher who facilitates the LGBT society at my school, is actually setting up a website. He's posting up all the talks that they're doing and stuff. The children are posting things on there as well. And the idea is that it should be a resource that other schools share as well. As he said, it will only be homophobia when we've got an LGBT society in every school in the country, and I agree with that. Tony.
So, one of my long-term friends. Should I just shout?
Shout, I'll repeat the question.
One of my long-term friends.
One of my long-term friends.
One
said to me.
Should we do it to music? I forgot what I was going to say. It's difficult growing up gay. And something we both found, we're both librarians, we wasted, well, it's not the right word, wasted, but we used a lot of time finding out who we are. We tried different groups, we tried this, meetings like this. I'm a bit unusual, but I'm unusual anyway. I don't drink, so I've never had much interest in the gay pubs. In fact, I regard them as something that ought to belong to the past. And my complaint about CHE was I think it did a lot of good work, but it also acted as a recruiting agency for the Backstreet pubs. And I soon got very tired of it because I felt this is not gay liberation. It's partly gay liberation, but it's not the whole story. And I find myself craving for a situation where we can just be gay. We don't have to go anywhere. We don't have to spend money. We don't have to join groups. We just are gay.
Yes, I would agree with that. And I think actually it's quite promising now, because what's happening now is there are a lot of groups which are geared to other activities. You know, if you go, there are sites called Gay Mates, for example, which actually have a lot of events advertised for, say, older gay men that are not based on pubs. They're based on going for walks, going to the cinema, you know, going to the theatre together, all those kind of things. Now, CHE, to be fair to it, did always do those other things as well. What it would do is it would have a meeting in a church hall or a friend meeting house or something like that, and then go to the pub afterwards, and that's where your beef is. But it was never, the pub was never the whole story, but it's true, it was part of our culture. But it's part of our culture anyway, isn't it? That's the problem. It's not just CHE, it's what people do. So you can always have a soda, you know, St. Clements or something like that. Yes,
hello. I saw the film Victim recently, and I was just kind of curious as to the kind of impact it had when it came out in 1961.
Well, the Victim tends to get all the publicity these days because it is so directly related to the specific gay situation and the law reform thing. It had a lot of impact on certainly gay people. I mean, you go along, there were audiences that were made up entirely of gay men watching that film. Indeed, screenings of Victim became known as Great Pickup Place as well, as indeed the queue did to get into the public gallery in the House of Commons or House of Lords when homosexual law reform was being debated. But in terms of public opinion, changing the attitudes of lawmakers, I think its influence has been overplayed. I really do. Because essentially I think only the people who believed in it would have gone to see that film. Nobody would have gone to see it who was homophobic. So there's very little in the middle, people in the margins who are undecided, it would have changed minds, yes. But how many of those there were, I honestly don't know. But what I should say is that actually Victim was only one of a whole series of films, which I do think had an effect. Some of the others I think may have had more effect because the gay characters were embedded in a story which wasn't gay. And I would draw attention to The L-Shaped Room and Murray Melvin's lovely, lovely gay character, Jeffrey, in that, who is the best friend of the central character.
Taste of Honey, yes.
The Trial of Oscar Wilde, Peter Finch, which they're showing on London Live at the moment. That had a great effect, I think. As well, there was a film called Darling, made by a gay director, John Schlesinger, which had a very strong gay character in it, who wasn't particularly camp. He was the gay best friend of the central character, played by Julia Christie, and he was shown cheerfully picking up Italian boys and going off on the back of Vespas and stuff when they went on holiday, and stuff. And that was a kind of part of the process of normalisation, I think, which is more important, if you like, than the victim itself. That's my feeling, but I may be in a minority of one on that. Yes, please.
Yeah. 67 Act didn't mean that gays stopped being prosecuted. In fact, there were more prosecutions for underage sex and for gross indecency and importuning after 67 than before. You mentioned the Esquire clubs and the fact that they might have people who are under 21 in them. If they had actually happened, they could have been prosecuted for conspiracy to corrupt public morals, or conspiracy to corrupt the minds and morals of minors. There were also police investigations both in Bradford and in Wales in the 1970s, which the conspiracy cases, which didn't actually happen. But the International Times, the underground paper, which did gay contact advertisements, was successfully prosecuted for conspiracy to corrupt the public morals.
Yes, absolutely. The conspiracy charges were, in the end, more effective as a deterrent and as a punishment and used more than the actual 67 Act. I've just been writing about the whole series of them. There was the Little Red School Book, there was the IT trial over personal ads, there was Oz, which was largely a homosexual issue as far as the prosecution was concerned, well, a lesbian issue, because there were supposedly lesbians cavorting on the cover of a particular issue of ours that was prosecuted. There were a whole series of them. Conspiracy remained very much a live issue into the 1980s. Yes, please.
And it was one of the main reasons why the Charity Commission took years and years to ever formally recognise the many charitable applications from budding charities to become registered, because the Charity Commission would always have a ready excuse, obviously. We can't register a charitable organisation, a body who's perhaps secondary or tertiary purpose, maybe the resulting of a homosexual meeting one another, which could be argued in court as depraving public morals. So for many, many years, the whole law reform movement, raising of public consciousness against the inequities and injustices, was inhibited by nobody, no legitimate, otherwise legitimate bona fide body, being granted charitable status.
Yes, well, the key thing for that is actually part of the judgment of the IT case, where the judge came out with the phrase that homosexuality was legal but not lawful, whatever that meant. Mm-hmm. Basically, all it had done is it become exempt from penalty under certain circumstances, but that did not make it lawful. And also, that's why gay charities as such could not get charitable status. But the other thing that plays into that is that the law was much, as far as charity was concerned, was much more strict in those days about campaigning as part of your objects. You know, it was policed a lot more. It's been relaxed recently over the last few years. So gay organisations have been allowed to campaign who wouldn't have been allowed to previously. I mean, the Albany Trust was set up in order to get charitable status for half of what the HLRS did. That to get around that particular aspect of the law. And even then, they got into trouble with the charity commissioners and had several investigations. But yes, you're absolutely right.
We're only going to have time for one more question.
Can I have one from the lady? Sorry.
Can I ask you about alliances, if they existed, with the civil rights movement in the US? So I'm just thinking about race in what you're describing.
Not so much in this country, I don't think. The HLRS had very good alliances with the lesbian organisation. Anthony lived in the same street as a woman called Esme Langley, who was the founder of the Minorities Research Group, the first lesbian organisation in this country, and Arena 3, the first lesbian magazine. And in fact, because they lived in the same street, they jokingly called it Queer Street. So because of this kind of relationship, there was actually a very good sort of alliance between Minority Research Charge Group and the HLRS, I think. Black issues in this country, as far as gay women are concerned, came very, very late. And it was more to do with GLF as well. Gay Liberation Front was much, much more conscious of that. CHE, to its shame, really didn't do much about it until the mid-70s, under the influence of GLF as well.
Okay, thank you very much, Peter. I'd like to thank you again.
Anyway, sharing the booze with you. So if anybody wants to carry on talking about this, I'm very happy to chat informally.
That's an offer that's very hard to turn down. So please do come and join us for a drink now. We've got some refreshments over at the back. And I'd like to thank you all very much for coming and for giving your time to come and listen to Peter's fascinating talk. I'd also like to thank both Open Doors London and Spectrum for helping us to organise this event. But most of all, I'd like to thank Peter for his fantastic talk. Thank you.